Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. On a hot August day in 1955, Lulu and Percy Haynes met in a Cumberland County courtroom to receive the judge's order finalizing their domestic case, a divorce case. Percy Haynes responded violently when Judge Mark Garber ordered him to pay Lulu $50 a month in support. And according to press reports, he pulled a .22 caliber handgun out of his shirt pocket and opened fire. Four people were shot, including attorney John Faller, who later died. Next Friday, a week from today, the Cumberland County Bar Association is reenacting the event. Event organizer Ron Turo and George Faller, who is playing his uncle, the nephew of the murdered lawyer, are in the studio today to talk about the event. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Scott.
Morning, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment about this, this is fascinating history here in central Pennsylvania. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, I got to say, Ron, this is fascinating, and I'm curious about the impetus. Why did you want to reenact this? I mean, it's a murder that occurred almost 70 years ago.
Well, a couple things caught my interest. Number one, it happened in 1955, as you mentioned. That was the year I was born. And when I started researching the whole situation and found that this was an incredibly unusual situation to have happened, in central Pennsylvania, as far as I know, there has never before or since been a shooting of a judge or the killing of a lawyer in a courtroom. I was part of a history walking tour that the Cumberland County Historical Society does regularly in Carlisle. And as we walked by the old courthouse, I said to the event organizer, her name's Linda Mann, it'd be great to have a walking tour of the old courthouse because it's a fascinating place. It's historical. And many people don't know about it, never even been inside of our ceremonial courtroom. And she was excited about that, and I started looking into it, and I segued into this incident, and I approached the Historical Society, so they're a partner of the event, and I approached the Cumberland County Bar Association to do a continuing legal situation and reenacting. And when I talked to lawyers, the first lawyer I talked to was George, of course, because his uncle was involved. And the Historical Society wanted to make sure that his family would have no issues with us reenacting this. George was in 100%, and we put together a great team of Cumberland County Bar Association members who are playing the various roles. And we'll, at the end of the reenactment, talk about who that character was and what happened to them thereafter. So it'll be very interesting.
We're going to tell the story here in just a moment, but George, I'm curious. Your family has a long history in Cumberland County. Through the years, what did you hear about your uncle John?
Basically, all I knew was that he was a trial lawyer, great trial lawyer, had an excellent reputation, but that he was shot and killed in a domestic case when he was 41 in the old courthouse, that he was local counsel, didn't really have a big part in the thing, but he was the victim. So I think when Ron approached me, I had the idea that people will think there's a macabre aspect to this. So the first thing I did was checked with my uncle's son and grandson to make sure it was okay with them, you know, and that they didn't have any ill feelings. And then I thought the idea would be to research and find out, you know, what really happened, why, and look into it.
Ron, we've all seen TV shows or movies where the accused somehow got access to a gun, or a family member of the victim looking for revenge pulls out a firearm and shoots someone in the courtroom. But as you mentioned, as far as you know, only time here in central Pennsylvania. In researching this, you have found another case in Pennsylvania. That was in Mercer County, like just a year or so before. But this is still very unusual. Hollywood aside, this doesn't happen.
No, it really doesn't. And, of course, one of the great ironies, and George and I were discussing this, if you go to the new Cumberland County Courthouse today and you go inside for any matter of business or court-related stuff, we have metal detectors and deputy sheriffs, great security. You go into the same courtroom where this happened today, there is no security. It's totally wide open. So it's unusual in that, first of all, there was no security to stop it, but there hasn't been since. It just doesn't happen that litigants pull out guns and start shooting people in courtrooms. I mean, thank God that doesn't happen. But it did in this case, and Percy himself, George has found the receipt of the gun that he bought when he went to Nevada to get a divorce in 1954. He went to Nevada to get both a divorce and a gun, and he came to court this day, August 2nd, 1955, and he sewed the gun into his jacket. And when he was ordered to pay support by the judge, which infuriated him, he stood up, pulled the gun out, and ended up shooting four people, and one died.
All right, so August 1955, 63 years ago today, Percy and Lulu Haynes. Now, you don't find too many people named Percy or Lulu, young children today, so those were names that were popular in the 1950s or in the 1920s when they were born. But Percy and Lulu Haynes, they were involved in a domestic case. It was a divorce. So what was this case about? And as you mentioned, this is a good example of legal education for members of the Bar Association, but things were different at that time, weren't they?
Yeah, and I think that set the stage. In 1955, you could not get a no-fault divorce in pretty much any state in the country. These people, Percy and Lulu, in 1955, were both 60 years old. They had eight grown children. And this was a claim for spousal support because a spouse had to support his wife if he was able. So Lulu had...
When you say spouse, a husband.
Had to support his wife.
Because most of the time, women weren't working at that time.
Correct. So it was a support hearing for her to prove spousal support. And she lived in Franklin County, so it was originally filed in Franklin County. But the idea, the thing that the listeners have to focus on is you couldn't just get a no-fault divorce at the time. So they were still married even though they had been estranged off and on for 20 years. And the hearing was in Cumberland County because that's where Percy lived. But Lulu had filed originally in Franklin County. But to get jurisdiction over Percy, they had to have the hearing in Cumberland County.
And that's where your uncle comes in. Your uncle had to appear in the courtroom because he was a Cumberland County attorney, but he had nothing to do with the case, correct?
Correct. The Pennsylvania Bar Association, about 10 years before, 1947, had asked the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to allow lawyers to practice anywhere. But at this time, in 1955, Pennsylvania was probably the only state in the country that you could not go to a different county and try a case or appear in court. You needed a local counsel to affiliate with to sit there with you. And that is the only reason my uncle was there.
And you're playing your uncle in the reenactment next week. How many speaking parts do you have?
Yeah, it was an hour-long hearing, 60, 70-page transcript, and he did not say a word.
But yet, he was the only one killed.
He was the only one that did not survive.
Ron, I'm curious about this. It's been a long time since I've been in a courtroom covering a trial or a court case, but I've been in courtrooms, and the two of you tell me whether this happens, where a judge will say, from an out-of-town to an out-of-town lawyer, I remember one case in particular where the judge said, Mr. So-and-so, that may be how you practice in Philadelphia, but here's what we do. I mean, does that still exist?
No, it really doesn't. Now that we do have true statewide practice, and George and I both, as trial lawyers, we've both been in front of judges all over the place, George even more so than me. But I can tell you, no matter what lawyer comes into a Cumberland County courtroom today, she's treated with the same respect and appropriateness from our judges as any of our local attorneys are. So those days are gone. But like you, in my early days of practice, Scott, 30 years ago, I saw that happen. And one of the things we used to do in Cumberland County is we had a regular miscellaneous day on Tuesday mornings. All the lawyers would come in and present motions, etc. The judge always called the most senior Cumberland County lawyer first. So let's say it was Mr. Douglas, who was an institution in Cumberland County. Mr. Douglas would always go first. Another attorney from Dauphin County could have more years and more seniority and more prestige. he goes last. And so that's just the way it worked. That was one of the unique ironies of our system. That doesn't happen anymore.
Now, that's one of the personal ironies to me, too, because I joined my current law firm because I wanted to be a trial lawyer, and I've had jury trials in probably 12, 14, 15 different counties and cases in 30 counties right now. And it's just such a foreign concept that you needed a passport to go across the river to try a case in Harrisburg.
All right, well, let's get back to the story. The judge is Mark Garber. Do either of you, I don't know how, none of these people are still alive, correct?
No. They're all, in fact, I guess, was it George Black that just died? One of the...
George Black was actually Lulu's attorney who practiced in Franklin County.
Right, yeah.
So what happened, you know, the you had mentioned that Percy had gone to Nevada, tried to get a divorce. Judge Garber said...
No. What Judge Garber said was... And when I initially started doing the research, this struck me as being a judge, I thought, operating inappropriately, to be very honest with you. Well, we've done some research, and George has found cases that at that time in Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania courts allowed local judges to basically say, no, I don't think that was a legitimate divorce from out of state because you didn't live there for a long enough period or you only went there to get a divorce. So Judge Garber, he heard the testimony. There was a divorce decree. Percy was, quote, divorced in Nevada. But Judge Garber ruled that the divorce would not be applied in Cumberland County. And therefore, Percy was still married. And therefore, Percy still had an obligation to pay support. And when he ordered Percy to pay support, Percy became a little upset about that and stood up and basically said, I can't pay this. His lawyer said, we'll talk about it later, Percy. He pulled out the gun and started shooting people. And he got 5 of 6 shots off from his revolver.
And he hit 4 people.
He hit 4 people. And in fact, George and I were just talking about this. It appeared the 5th shot was also being fired at the judge because Percy stood up. It was counsel table in front of the bar. And he shot his wife and John Fowler. And then
George Black
from Chambersburg. And then he walked behind the bench and pointed the gun and shot at Judge Garber, which hit him in the left arm. And then he tried to get another shot off, I guess, as he was being tackled.
Yeah, George Geiger, who was in his early 20s, a Korean War veteran, jumped up from the court reporter's seat and tackled Percy and sat on him, and Percy's son and daughter were in the courtroom. The daughter came up, hit him over the head with a chair, and they essentially disarmed him until the sheriff's deputies did come up.
So it sounds like son and daughter were a mom side?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They were.
Yeah. Well, you know, in today's courtroom, now I don't know about civil cases, divorce cases, but in criminal cases, there's sheriff's deputies, there's bailiffs. I mean, there are a lot of people in the courtroom that whenever a defendant stands up or makes any kind of motion that would seem threatening, that they're right there. None of that existed?
None of that existed. There was no security in the courtroom at all. And today, even in just a normal civil case, it could be, you know, me suing you over your dog biting my child or something. There are deputies in every courtroom, in every hearing, at all times, as security, as you say, not only for the judge and for the attorneys, but for participants. Plus, nobody would be able to get through with a gun sewed into their, you know, so
right.
That. The only thing that ever came close is I know in a one murder case I was involved in, the defendant was very upset when he was sentenced to death, and he hauled off and smacked his attorney, you know, just round the house at him. So then he, of course, was immediately tackled, but he couldn't kill him because he didn't have any way to do that.
So he actually had time enough to shoot 3 people and then get up and walk around the table and still shoot at the judge.
Absolutely.
Correct.
Well, it didn't take long. I mean, if when we timed it out, it was probably 10 seconds. I mean, he stood up, bang, 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 walk around, bang, tackled. It was all over in 30 seconds.
So 4 people are shot, but only one, your uncle, George, your Uncle John was the only one was killed. What kind of wounds did he suffer?
He was shot in the chest and crawled out the back door of the courthouse or back door of the courtroom, crawled downstairs into the clerk's office. And it was a 22, so it wasn't a very
large caliber.
But at that time, you know, the medical capabilities just weren't enough to save him. He died at the hospital within an hour.
Okay, but you know, I'm trying to picture this. He crawled down to the clerk's office. Didn't anyone help?
Everybody, there's only the four people that had gotten shot and Percy's son and daughter and the court reporter, and they're all jumping on him.
No one heard the shots?
Well, they hear the shots and the deputies come running and they're disarming the guy with the gun.
And John, as George said, John literally crawled down in the staircase in the old courthouse is an extremely long and tall one, and he crawled down to the downstairs floor of the courthouse. Judge Garber went to the back where the judge's offices were, and he ran into Judge Shugart, who was our president judge and had been for many, many years. And he called
and
him
another
an ambulance.
Familiar Cumberland County name.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So I think Judge Shugart ended up calling an ambulance or whatever. Now, so all of a sudden you have four victims. When was the last time in Carlisle history before that you had four shooting victims? Extremely rare.
And, 1863.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, people helped as they could. They laid Lulu out on a bench. I think her daughter and son sort of took care of her. John's downstairs. Garber's in the back. I don't know where George Black ended up. But.
There's so much more to this. A fascinating story. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up in the second half of the program, we're going to be talking about Harrisburg University's esports program. It's becoming more popular amongst Pennsylvania, well, not just Pennsylvania, but across the country. Universities and colleges that are competing in video games. Harrisburg University actually offering 16 full-ride scholarships to those who are on their esports team, the Storm. And we'll be talking about that in the second half of today's program. But up front, a fascinating story. A reenactment next Friday, a week from today, at the historic Cumberland County Courthouse of a 1955 murder. It was a divorce case where a man by the name of Percy Haynes pulled out a gun when he got a ruling he didn't like and shot four people, killing one. John Faller is the attorney, John Faller Jr. His nephew, George Faller, is with us today, along with Ron Toro, who came up with this idea of reenacting this case in the old Cumberland County Courthouse. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so we've established that this is a very unusual case. Now, one thing we have We have an email from a listener who points out that, and I think we had mentioned this earlier, that this wasn't the only shooting in a courtroom in Pennsylvania. There was actually a judge killed in Mercer County. Ron, you didn't know about that until you researched this case, right?
That's exactly right. I started looking around thinking, well, gee, maybe this is more frequent than I knew because people just don't talk about it, or maybe it is rare. And we did find the one. George found an article about it. But I believe it was in January of 54.
Right. Is that what it was? Judge Allison Wade in Warren County.
Warren County.
And,
was it Warren County?
Warren
I'm
County.
Sorry.
And the circumstances were almost identical. It was a support case. The guy was ordered to pay support. And he stood up and started shooting at the attorney. The judge started screaming, "Don't shoot me, I won't order it." And he said, you're GD right, you're not going to order it. And he put 2.45 slugs in the judge's chest and killed the judge.
So the judge, staring down the barrel of a gun, said, "I'll rescind that order."
Yeah.
But it didn't work out that way.
Yeah. And he ended up getting the death penalty, which I believe, was commuted at some point to life, that particular defendant.
Well, right. That brings up the point of what happened to Percy Haynes then. I mean, by the way, your uncle, how long did he live before he died?
He lived about an hour. My father
was only an hour.
We lived about a block from the Carlisle Hospital, and my dad got a call. He was home for lunch, and his brother died at the hospital within about an hour of the shooting. And, you know, the thing was, when we first started or were getting into doing this, we're like, well, it's a historical thing, but are there any legal issues? And as it started to unfold, the legal issues were just fascinating because, as you said, the Percy was apprehended right away, but he was taken into custody. The attorney's notes from his attorney were given to the district attorney. In other words, his whole support file from his lawyer, privileged and confidential, was given with a big three-page type statement. Here's what happened with Percy and what I had told him about before the support hearing, and I didn't know he had the gun.
So the murder charge doesn't supersede anything that he had with his attorney beforehand?
Well, I mean, there was no mention about privilege at all. The attorney-client privilege for his support file got turned over to the district attorney, and Percy was taken to jail, and I think Ron found the pictures that were taken the next day.
That was another you know, I've been a criminal defense lawyer all my professional life, and the next day, the very next day, Percy is brought by the Carlisle Police Department. We have pictures of officers bringing him into the courtroom, and then they said, Percy, reenact for us so we can take pictures, exactly what happened. And we have pictures with Percy standing by the bench, pointing his finger out like he's a gun and shooting where the judge was. And when I found those pictures, Scott, I was just blown away. I was like, that would never happen today. You wouldn't bring it. Of course, he was unrepresented. And they just brought him up, and he was just very mild, matter-of-fact about, yeah, I got up, this is what I did, bang, bang, bang. They took all the pictures. It was absolutely fascinating.
From what you're describing today, it sounds like there'd be some grounds for appeal.
Oh, there'd be. Well, and the other fascinating thing, and this shocked me, and I know George, too, we were just talking about it. This shooting took place August 2nd. He went to trial on a first-degree homicide charge.
With the death penalty.
With the death penalty.
On the table.
At the end of September, early October.
But by October.
Within 2 months.
Yeah.
You would never, with two forensic psychiatrists having testified, with two lawyers representing them, you know, it's unheard of and unprecedented in that respect. This wouldn't happen.
But he got a life sentence rather than a death penalty.
And his lawyers did a great job because this clearly was premeditated. I mean, he walked into courtroom, he was going to kill somebody, at least shoot them. Absolutely. But he got a life sentence. And the argument was that, you know, there were some mental issues, and they went through all that.
But. And he had bought the gun in Nevada when he got the divorce. Within a month after the shooting, they were able to get the receipt that showed October 30th, 1954. He had bought the gun in Reno, like shortly after the Reno divorce was granted to him. So that was like fascinating.
We have Stephen from Chambersburg, and I understand that Stephen is related to Percy Haynes. Stephen, explain your relationship to Percy Haynes.
I would be his grandson.
You are Percy's?
My mother was the woman who was in court that day.
And your mother was the one who hit your grandfather over the head with a chair?
No, she did not hit him with the chair. She threw a chair at him. Matter of fact, I remember the papers at that time showing an arc from where she was and throwing this chair.
Well, can I say that
my Uncle George, who was there, and my mother both, my Uncle George said to Percy, "Dad, give me the gun." And he handed the gun to my Uncle George. My Uncle George then handed the gun to the court reporter. But that was a family story.
We certainly would love this gentleman to attend the reenactment if he's able, and if not, I certainly would love to talk to him further about it, because we have not, until this moment, actually been able to find any direct relations with Percy. So I'm really glad you called in, sir, and I hope you'll be in touch with us.
Stephen, do you think you could attend next week?
No, I can't.
Well, can you?
But there are quite a few descendants around.
Well, we'd love to talk to them.
Okay, well, Ron, what can he do to get in touch with you?
If he uses email, he can email me at Toro, T-U-R-O, the number one, at PA.net.
Can you do that, Stephen?
Second to write it. Get that something to write it down. Repeat it, please.
It's Toro, T-U-R-O, the number one. No, T-U.
U-O?
T-U-R-O.
Okay.
The number one.
Mm-hmm.
At PA.net.
PA.net.
All right, so Stephen, while I have you on the line here, so what did you, you know, I asked Mr. Fowler about the stories that he heard in his family. What stories did you hear in your family?
Well, like I said, from my uncle and my mother both, they claimed that I knew my mother had thrown the chair at him. I remember reading copies of the newspaper she had in the attic when I was young, because I was only, I was born in 48, so I wasn't very old when this occurred. But I do remember them saying about her throwing the chair, and then my Uncle George asking for the gun, and he handed the gun to my Uncle George.
So,
and that's all I know.
I noticed you called your grandfather Percy.
Right.
Did you call him grandfather or grandpa or anything like that? Or was that something that because, you know, of what he did, he kind of was the black sheep of the family, obviously?
Well, I didn't really. I maybe knew my grandfather when I was a toddler. So I don't really remember what I called him or anything and everything. So, like I said, I was, at 55, I'd have been going on 7 years old. And, of course, this, the divorce and everything was ongoing. I didn't, as a kid, didn't know anything about it.
Mm. Well, Stephen, I'm glad you called in, and contact Ron Toro, and we'll explore this story even further, okay?
I will try to.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Boy, what about that?
That's awesome. And again, Scott, I hope that at the end here we can also give a phone number for people, mainly because this is open to the public, but we're doing that sign up through the Cumberland County Historical Society. And anyone's interested in attending can call them at 717-249-7610.
All right, and we'll put that phone number on our website, WITF.org.
That would be awesome.
Scott, the one last irony that I thought is that my uncle was shot and killed because they needed a local council, and Pennsylvania was the only state that was still doing this. During the murder trial, two lawyers were appointed to represent Percy, one from Harrisburg that had more experience with capital cases, which obviously showed since he got a life sentence. But there needed to be a Cumberland County lawyer appointed. At my dad's memorial service, I learned that nobody wanted to do it. And my father actually went to the lawyer and said, hey, look, the system needs to have this man have a lawyer. But during the trial, the Cumberland County lawyer had a heart attack, and I found a newspaper article that said trial of Percy Haynes continued without a Cumberland County lawyer at the table. And there was no mention of it's required by the Pennsylvania and by the rules.
Yeah.
So I guess in certain situations, you didn't need local counsel.
By the way, we had a listener who said she was in junior high when this occurred, and she remembers it distinctly and said it was as big of news as the Kennedy assassination in Carlisle, that it was shocking in the whole town, that it was that big of a news story. Ron Toro and George Fowler, thank you very much. Next Friday at 3 o'clock, the Old Cumberland County Courthouse called the Historical Society to get tickets. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Video game competitions between colleges and universities are becoming a larger part of the college sports scene. Harrisburg University of Science and Technology is striving to be one of the nation's leaders in esports. Full ride scholarships are being offered to gamers who are part of Harrisburg U's new team, The Storm. And we are joined by the president of Harrisburg University of Science and Technology, Eric Darr. President Darr, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. Good to be here.
If you have a question or a comment about esports, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. That's the number to call. If you have a question or a comment, you can go to WITF's Facebook page. You also could send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I have to say, Eric, that it's not often we get the president of a university coming in to talk about their sports team, but this is the very first sports competition. You know, there are some people who question whether esports actually is a sport, but this is a big deal for Harrisburg University, isn't it?
This is a big deal for us. This is the only sport that we have, the only student athletes, varsity athletes that we have, and absolutely, this is significant for us, and we're thrilled to be the first one in Pennsylvania. After our announcement, several others have already joined in, and so we feel like we were the ones that broke the ice.
So I know Lebanon Valley College has an esports team. So you called the participants, the players, athletes. Are they athletes? Is this a sport?
It's absolutely a sport. It's the same adrenaline rush that other athletes get. Two of the game titles that we're playing are team sports. That is, one's a five-person team, the other's a six-person team. How you behave as a team is equally important, if not more important, in esports as it is in anything else. How do you handle wins? How do you handle losses? The whole notion of practice time, you have to put in your time, you have to be structured in your thinking. All of those things are just like any other athletic pursuit.
So how did this all come to be?
Well, I'm a gamer. I've been playing video games with my son for nearly 20 years.
Are you any good?
Not nearly as good as the players, no. The day job kind of gets in the way, Scott. But so I understood the draw of games, you know, and we've had at Harrisburg University a game design program for a very long time, and games. The development of video games is, nearly a $40 billion industry. And so, as something that people care about, we understood that very, very well. The competitive nature of esports was something that, has grown up over the last 5 years, 6 years, and largely part in other parts of the world, South Korea, China being kind of the first and foremost. And so, its popularity in North America is just now kind of rapidly on the rise. And for us, if we're going to get into a sport, it was this made a lot of sense. That and coupled with the arrival of a new executive director at the Whitaker Center who had the notion of esports, Ted Black, and the idea that we could jointly put in place esports as a spectator sport, which is very different than most other colleges and universities. Other colleges and universities, they put six people in a closet and they play online versus six other people in some closet in another part of the United States. It's not ever really been thought about except in championship level as a spectator sport. Well, with the partnership with the Whitaker Center, Harrisburg University, we've thought about esports as a spectator participant sport from the very beginning.
So I'm trying to picture this. Of course, picturing the Whitaker Center, I've been there many times, but will, when you're playing a video game with your son, it's on your TV for the most part, or computer, but probably the TV. I imagine that this will be projected on a larger screen so the spectators can see it?
Correct. So, the Whitaker Center has two venues, and the digital theater is a perfect screen. Much like any movie or any game, the sound, the video is an engagement of the audience. It engages you. And so what better than a 40-foot digital screen at the Whitaker Center that wraps around the audience, if anyone has ever been in that space. It's an amazing space. You know, that's, the principal place. And then they have the bigger 700 person, and that's going to have to be some more digital screens put up and some other things. But if one thinks, 700 people, who would 700 people come in to watch a competitive video game? I was just in the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, New York for the championships of the Overwatch League, and there were 15,000 people in the Barclays Center, which is where the New York Nets basketball team
right.
plays.
Yeah.
15,000 people. They could have easily sold another 15,000 tickets for people to go and watch that. And it was large screens, but it was every bit the experience that you would have if you were to go watch any professional sports team.
Is that an important part of why you did this? Because it could be a spectator sport. I mean, let's face it, in a college setting, many people think mm-hmm. of football and basketball right off the bat, the two sports that get the most spectators. But was that an important part of this?
Just on that point, I'll answer the question. But just right now, today, esports are the second most watched sport in the world behind soccer. So there are, on any given day, even in the United States, there are more people watching esports than football or basketball or Major League Baseball. So they just do it online rather than in giant stadiums. So from a spectator perspective, esports is already the second most watched sport in the world. For us, two reasons why Harrisburg University got into this. One was to engage our community. And by our community, I don't just mean the community of Harrisburg University, our students and staff faculty. I mean the community of Harrisburg in central Pennsylvania, and to have something to root for in a very different way. And sports do that, right? They provide an opportunity for people to get behind a team and to root for that team. And we hope that happens. The other reason was to get the name of Harrisburg University out, right? So we've already had articles about our teams and how we recruited our teams and our players, which we just introduced yesterday, on ESPN. How else would Harrisburg University ever been on ESPN, right? We had an HBO piece on Vice News done about the university, 5-minute segment on HBO. I got calls from college and high school friends of mine that I haven't heard in 30 years. Hey, I saw you on HBO. I mean, that was the other reason why we created this esports team.
I want to follow up, and this is a little bit off track, but something you just mentioned, when the university gets that kind of attention. I have read accounts where Penn State, for example, when the football team has a good record, they get more applications. Do you think that will happen with Harrisburg University of Science and Technology, that when people find out about this, maybe from that ESPN story or that HBO story, that you will get more applications?
We've already seen it. We haven't played a single game yet, and we've already seen an uptick in applications. Because of the publicity that we've received.
How do you know that?
You pay attention to...
No, but I mean, that you've got more. That's easy to see. But
right.
I mean, that was
then,
because of that.
Well, and part of the questioning when somebody submits an inquiry or an application is, how did you hear about Harrisburg University? I mean, that's just standard procedure, not just for us, but mm-hmm. universities do that. You know, but to know, is our website effective? Is our partner that does recruiting for us, is it them? So you ask, and the answer comes back, oh, I saw, an article about you in ESPN, or I read about your esports team, or I saw you online, or so, we were able to track that.
Mm-hmm. All right, so you introduced the team yesterday. 16 players on the team?
Correct.
Okay.
And there's actually three teams across.
Because there's three games,
right? Three games.
What are those three games?
One is called Hearthstone. That's a fantasy card game. Players play cards. It's an individual game. You play cards and you try to beat your opponent. And these are magical cards, and that's the way that game works. Second game would be League of Legends. That's the most popular game that's in the world right now. That's a five-person against five people. Think of Capture the Flag. That's essentially what that game is like. And then the third game is called Overwatch, and that's six versus six. And that's, again, a team that tries to defend a certain geography against another team that's trying to attack a certain geography.
So three teams, you have 16 players. How did you recruit those players? How did you find out about these players that obviously they're good enough to get scholarships?
It's a fascinating world, esports. So the game manufacturers keep track of their players. And so you can go online and you can find out, you know, Scott Lamar, his statistics. What did he do in his last game? What did he do in the game before that? What did he do in, you know, 2 months ago in the game? Very detailed statistics. They keep rankings of players in various segments of the world. North American rankings, Korean rankings, Chinese rankings, European rankings. You can find out where you rank versus anybody else that plays League of Legends. So out of that, you know, we, through social media, issued a call for anybody that's interested and got 500 people that applied. Out of that 500, we did online scrimmages cut that down to 36.
So they had to earn their way onto the team.
So then those 36, we flew them, the players, to Harrisburg. So there were several Canadians. There was a player out of Croatia, a player out of France. We flew all 36 players to Harrisburg because, again, we're building a team. We actually turned down the number one ranked player in North America because he didn't fit with the team. So we have players on Harrisburg University's team. This is the difference between esports and other sports that have been professional esports players. They've been paid to play esports, and now they're back into the collegiate world. This is one of the differences, and this is what's allowed. Many colleges have professional players on their teams, and so we have some of the highest ranked players in the world that are on the Harrisburg University team. So out of then the 36, we conducted interviews, we had them do scrimmages against each other, and picked the 16 that we thought would work best together as a team.
So, and that is a big difference between like NCAA rules for other sports,
right,
that you must be an amateur. Of course, we know there's always a lot of question about what kind of compensation there is other than the scholarship, and you know there are a lot of things there. But in a case like this, I mean, you're not an NCAA member. There are no rules that say that these players must be amateurs.
No, it's the esports at the college level is governed by an organization called NACE, the National Association of Collegiate Esports. There are about a few more than 80 universities across the United States that are part of NACE. NACE organizes the tournaments. NACE has rules about practice times and academic advancement because they do have the same notion of a student athlete, students first, athletes second. But this idea that there's this line between amateur and pro that's in many cases fake. They don't play that game. What will be interesting is that when and if the NCAA sanctions esports, and the belief is that they will eventually get there and sanction esports because there's too much money. It's a billion-dollar industry. And if we know one thing, you know, about the NCAA, an interest in money. And so so eventually, I think the belief is that that they'll get in. And then we'll see how it plays out with regard to this notion of the difference between an amateur and a pro.
So just to clarify, all members of the team, they are students?
Correct.
Do most of them, what are most of their majors?
Not what you would expect. So we do have a fair number that are computer science majors. We have some that are interactive media majors. We have some that are biotechnology majors. And so they had to meet the same admissions requirements as any other student. They're going to have to advance the same way any other student does. We have some that are true freshmen, meaning they've never been to a college before. We have some that are transfer students that have been as many as, you know, 2-3 years at another university, and they'll transfer in as a sophomore or a junior and then participate in academics from that point forward.
Do they have to maintain a minimum grade point average?
They do.
Just like other...
Just like anybody else.
Okay. You mentioned flying in players from all over the world. How much money has the university invested in this?
Well, the majority of the money invested has been in physical facilities. So we're retrofitting a space in the Whitaker Center for a practice arena. We're spending money to upgrade the technical infrastructure of the Whitaker Center to allow competitions. We retrofitted a second building to essentially be a home to the team. So when you count facility costs, in addition to the scholarships and sponsorships and those sorts of things, it's probably close to $2.5 million, $3 million we will spend on esports.
There probably are people who will look at that and say, wait a minute, you're spending $2.5 million for people to play video games. What about other students who academically don't have the opportunity to attend Harrisburg University, but those who are skilled at video games do?
I would say, well, what about the money spent, at Penn State on any set of, let alone football, because football generates its own revenue, but all the other sports teams and the money spent there? It's the same circumstance. It's on our esports team, we're providing access to students, and you can read stories because people have written stories from their own hometowns where these students athletes came from. Many small towns, they didn't have the access, they didn't have the financial ability to go to college. And so, much like our undergraduate students, we feel good about providing access to an education for these students, yes, because of their esports capabilities. But nonetheless, we're providing an opportunity for a world-class education that they otherwise wouldn't have. In a much better circumstance than, signing a pro contract for 6 months and then being cut. And then what do you do with the rest of your life, right?
Do you foresee being able to recoup some of that revenue?
Oh, absolutely. So one of the other pieces of esports, we're putting together with the support of NACE, the biggest collegiate esports tournament to date. That'll be 32 teams September 21st and 22nd in Harrisburg. It's called the Hue Fest, H-U-E Festival. So huefest.net is the website, or you can get to it off the Harrisburg University website. But that'll be 32 teams, probably from 20 to 25 different universities across the United States, coming to play esports in Harrisburg. So the opportunity for sponsorships of that festival, sponsorships of the tournament, is a way, sponsorships of the Harrisburg University team itself, the Storm. These are all ways to recoup part of the costs that we've expended. The other way universities look at athletics is it's a marketing expense. So how much would we have paid to be on HBO? How much would we have paid to be on the front page of ESPN? It would have been a fair amount of money. So some of the expenses treated as an ability to market. Mm-hmm.
Well, I got to say, the logo is really cool. It is
developed by a local company.
I was wondering about that.
Absolutely.
But just the logo is really cool. The team was introduced yesterday. All right, so I know you're biased, but what's the season look like?
I hope that we do real well. I'm not sure we're going to win. There are some really good teams that are out there that have been together, practicing together for years, and it takes time to gel together. I think technically we have as good a team as individually as any team out there, but it's the team aspect that will tell it. And so, if we do, semifinals of some of these tournaments, I'll be happy with that. Would I like to win? Heck yeah.
Harrisburg University of Science and Technology, the Notre Dame of esports?
Absolutely. Yes, indeed. Charting our own independent path, much like Notre Dame.
I'm curious, will you sell, I mentioned the logo and how cool it looks, will you sell merchandise and sweatshirts, that kind of thing?
Part of yesterday was introduction of the team jerseys. They too were designed, and Phalanx is the company here locally in Harrisburg that designed the logo and the jerseys. We will expect to generate some amount of revenue from merchandise sales. Absolutely, yes.
That is so cool. Hey, Eric, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Eric Darr is the president of Harrisburg University of Science and Technology. One thing I didn't ask, and I know I'm making a lot of comparisons so that people can put this in context with the sports that people are most familiar with, but is there a season? Is there a set number of competitions?
The season, yes. So the season for Overwatch begins September 28th and runs through the fall. The season for League of Legends begins later in the fall, and both of those wrap up in early winter. So that's the typical season.
Wow. And there will be a championship, a national championship in it?
There will indeed. Yes, okay. Indeed. Look for Harrisburg to be there.
By the way, we had a question real quick. Console or PC?
PC.
PC. Okay. Eric Darr, president of Harrisburg University of Science and Technology, thank you very much for being with us today. Coming up on Monday's program, State Representative Patty Kim will be with us to talk about Harrisburg legislation for the city of Harrisburg's finances.